Good morning, dear ones. Thank you for being here virtually. For me, it was sort of a struggle. However, with all the fake news that's spreading faster than the coronavirus, I thought it might be a good time to take on the issue of truth. But then I started looking at it and I thought, this is a really hard, complex topic. So what I want to ask is, what can we learn about truth and how do we separate truth and falsehood? So I'll talk about the complexities. Then I want to read you a parable and then we'll talk about methods we use. So can you hear me? And am I, is it all okay? Yeah, okay. Rosemary tells me that I should be looking at the camera. So I'm trying to do that, right? All right. So let me say there's no single story when it comes to truth. There's an oft-quoted biblical line, "You shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free." On the surface, that seems straightforward. But actually, what does "set you free" mean? Well, I presume it means that honesty is the best policy, and telling the truth is good for your soul. It puts your mind at ease, and it earns the respect and trust of others. However, I remember I was a therapist in prisons in Massachusetts, and the inmates would tell lots of different stories about why they were in prison. And for bank robbers, that was the highest status. If you could rob a bank, and then, you know, that was great. So they'd make up these stories about bank robbing heists, and then they'd worry that they had told so many different stories, they couldn't remember which one was true. So there's that complexity. Then family secrets. I'd say most of these involve, well, maybe paternity and sometimes maternity. So in the late 1950s, I have a friend, Claire, who's still my friend, and she got pregnant at 16. And she and her mom agreed that they would raise Claire's daughter, whose name is Bridget, as Claire's mother's daughter. So even to this day, we still call Bridget Claire's sister daughter. In any case, at 16, Claire decided to tell her daughter that her mom was not her mother and that she was her mother. And for a while, that created a rift. But I'm glad to say, you know, they're on good terms now. And then sometimes, and it may be true in your families, you don't find out family secrets until after somebody's died or you read through their paperwork or something like that. There's an old adage that says we're only as sick as the secrets we keep. And I suspect that we keep secrets because we're afraid of judgment. We want to not be shamed, or we're afraid of causing pain to others. So one of the things we might think about after service in our discussion groups is, am I holding on to any secrets that I'd like to reveal? So we can maybe dialogue about that. I read a statistic somewhere that said the average person tells 2 lies a day. Now, I'm not sure what kind of lies, because there's lots of different. So let's just say white lies. So white lies, they have no intention to harm or to hurt another person or to offer false information. So, for example, if I say, "Rosemary, do you like this dress? No, this outfit on me?" And Rosemary says, "Oh, yes, Barbara, it's just wonderful." She may not really feel that way, but she wants to preserve my social connections and make me feel okay. But perhaps another way to phrase that would be, "Well, you know, the outfit you wore yesterday, I like even better," or something like that. So part of truth-telling has to do with intention. And, you know, when we look at the broader issue of truth-telling, so say you're harboring an undocumented immigrant or historically hiding a Jew from the Nazis. Is telling the truth a good idea? Probably not, because you put the person who's involved in grave danger. So one of the things about lying is, or truth telling, is ask yourself, does it serve a higher good? And does it match up with my ethical principles? We teach our children that lying is wrong, and we want them to value honesty. And yet we may tell them there is a tooth fairy and a Santa Claus. So I'm not going to ask you to raise your hands how many have done that, however. But we may be offering a mixed message that honesty is the best policy. But it's also at times fine and preferable to lie about things. So I told my kids that there was a Santa Claus. And I don't know if my daughter was so scarred by this terrible experience that she decided to opt out for the Santa Claus ruse and use Elf on a Shelf. Did any of you use that with your kids? Also, parents, unless you feel guilty about the Santa Claus piece, lying seems to be something that kids start early and maybe even independent of their parents' messages. So in a laboratory experiment, a child is asked not to turn around and peek at a toy. The child is secretly filmed by hidden cameras for a few minutes. Then the experimenter returns and asks them if they peeked. Almost all three-year-olds do peek, and half of them lie about it. However, by the time children are five, all peek and all lie. Then there's that whole issue of truth-telling in the criminal justice system. Have any of you read Bryan Stevenson's Just Mercies? Essentially, it's a book about primarily Black men on death row in Alabama who were accused of a crime they didn't commit. And then we have a fascination, don't we, with the whodunit or who's telling the truth. I mean, judging by Judge Judy and all the crime shows on TV. And I once saw a quote that said, some liars are so expert, they deceive themselves. And I wonder sometimes about O.J. Simpson, that case where he said he did not kill his estranged wife. And yet we have no other credible suspects. And we make tragic mistakes in our criminal justice system, as we're seeing on the news right now. But sometimes court testimony can be humorous. So I looked online and I looked up stuff. And this is one that's purportedly a true transcript about, you know, whether do you promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. So examiner says to the woman, are you married? Answer, no, I'm divorced. Question, what did your husband do before you divorced him? Oh, a lot of things I don't know about. Certainly for most of us, being honest and telling our truth is essential to our being. As you use one of our cardinal principles is a responsible search for truth and meaning. And probably many of us subscribe to the dictionary definition of truth, that which is in accordance with fact or reality. And yet again, which facts or whose view of reality? And then another question is partial truth. So, Andrea, are your kids there? Do we have any teenagers? No, okay. Well, so I was going to say teenagers, listen up. So here's a little vignette about partial truth. So your mom asks you if you finished your homework, and you respond, I've written an essay on Thomas Jefferson for my English class. This may be true, but it doesn't actually answer the question about whether your homework was done. That essay could have been written a long time ago, and you misled your mother by partially making a truthful statement. You might not have even started your homework yet. So let me just delve a bit into the history of the study of truth. In the 1970s, a researcher named William G. Perry Jr. got interested in truth and lying and set out to study what constitutes knowledge, fact, and truth. By the way, a fancy word for knowledge is epistemology, and that just means it's a study of knowledge, justification, and the rationality of belief. I mean, how do we come to know what we know, essentially? So building on Perry's work in the late 1970s and 80s, a woman named Carol Gilligan and several other research women wanted to know how women viewed truth-telling and how they acquired knowledge. And of course, you know, a lot of times old research was just done on men and it was assumed that, you know, women felt the same way. So she did her work and published a study. And in fact, men and women probably don't differ that greatly in the methodology that they use to make decisions. But Gilligan is best known for her 1982 work in a different voice. And her work has been credited with inspiring the passage of the 1993 Gender Equity in Education Act. So in the Gilligan study, she across a broad spectrum of socioeconomics, studied 135 women and published the results in a book entitled Women's Ways of Knowing, which I first saw when I was in divinity school in 89 and found fascinating. So they concluded, in summary, that there are three maybe major categories of the way we understand knowledge and truth. So the first being sort of an either-or, a black and white approach, and it's dubbed dualism, and people who subscribe to this are called received knowers. For the dualist, absolute knowledge about truth comes primarily from external sources. And in their study, they noted that women who rely on a dualistic approach are likely to conform to social norms and gender roles as set by external authorities, and they don't like ambiguity. So I was thinking about this, and perhaps Phyllis Schlafly, the darling of the anti-ERA movement, might fall into this category. And then someone said, oh yeah, have you seen Mrs. America? It's a ERA Phyllis Schlafly thing on television. I haven't seen it, but maybe some of you have. And the authors noted in their study that received knowers generally had little experience with female role models in authority positions. And of course, blessedly, that's changing now. The second category they talk about is subjective knowledge. So this is like gut learning. In the Gilligan study, for women in this group, their inner voice, that is their gut feeling, in which they rely more on personal experience than outside authorities, was their primary way of knowing. And folks in this category tend to seek support and affirmation for those who agree with their position, which we all do to some extent. The third category she called procedural knowledge. Procedural knowledge reflects the recognition that multiple sources of knowledge exist and that procedures are necessary for evaluating the relative merit of these sources. Procedural knowers focus on methods and techniques for evaluating the accuracy of external truth and the relative worth of authority. So the pandemic is a perfect example. I mean, there's so much information flying around. How do you assess the truth of this knowledge? It's complicated, isn't it? But the main point of this one is to integrate the outer and inner voice. Of course, these three categories are not the only source of knowledge. I was talking to my longtime friend, Pris, were both psychologists together in the 70s, and she mentioned other sources like dreams, mystical experiences, magic mushrooms, psychedelics. Did any of you see the film Fantastic Fungi? Anyway, it was playing at our local independent movie theater. It praises psychedelic magic mushrooms as being a great source of wisdom and truth. Okay, I'm going to stop there. I want to read you a parable about truth and falsehood, and then I'll conclude with, you know, the ways we can use truth in our own life. How are we doing on time here? So this is entitled Truth, Falsehood, Fire, and Water. This is a tale about the eternal struggle of truth and falsehood, and it's told in Ethiopia and other African nations. Long ago, truth, falsehood, fire, and water were journeying together and came upon a herd of cattle. They talked it over and decided it would be fairest to divide the herd into four parts, so each could take home an equal share. But falsehood was greedy and schemed to get more for himself. "Listen to my warning," he whispered, pulling water into one side. "Fire plans if I were you, I'd extinguish and then we can have his share." And he dashed himself upon the fire and put him out. Next, falsehood crept toward truth. "Look what water has done," he whispered. "He has murdered fire and taken his cattle. We should not consort with the likes of him. We should take all the cattle and go to the mountains." Truth believed falsehood and agreed to his plan. Together they drove the cattle into the mountains. "Wait for me," Water called, and he hurried after them. But of course, he could not run uphill, so he was left all alone in the valley below. When they reached the top of the highest mountain, Falsehood turned to Truth and laughed. "I've tricked you, stupid fool," he shrieked. "Now you must give me all the cattle and be my servant, or I'll destroy you." "Yes, you have tricked me," Truth admitted, "but I will never be your servant." And so they fought. And when they clashed, the thunder rolled back and forth across the mountaintops. Again and again, they threw themselves together, but neither could destroy the other. Finally, they decided to call upon the wind to declare a winner of the contest. So wind came rushing up the mountain slopes, and he listened to what they had to say. "It's not for me to declare a winner in this fight," he told them. "Truth and falsehood are destined to struggle. Sometimes truth will win, but other times falsehood will prevail. And then truth must rise up again and fight. Until the end of the world, truth must battle falsehood and must never rest or let down his guard, or he will be finished once and for all." And so truth and falsehood are fighting to this day. So, kind of to recap, most of our knowledge comes from secondary sources. By that, I mean we hear it from somebody, we see it on TV, social media. And second, we tend to believe those we trust. So, I was listening to Dr. Fauci speaking about the coronavirus. And I trust him, and so I believe what he says, and so then I pass the information that I learn on to someone else. Or Governor Cuomo is another example of Governor of New York. Because I believe what he says when he says, "I will share with you what I know about this pandemic." However, speaking to someone the other day, and I said how much I believed Fauci, and she said, I can't stand him. He lies. So maybe this is the divide between who watches MSNBC and Fox News. I don't know. But since most of our knowledge is received from secondary sources, primarily other people, think of again about who do you trust with accurate information? And as I talked about, you know, truth being difficult to understand, and partial truth, and information we learn from other sources, and the intention, certainly I want to support information that brings the community together to build social trust. And certainly, you know, I think each of us does want to do that, don't we? And it may be also true in the personal world. And my mom had a saying, you know, don't say anything if it's not true, necessary, and kind. That might be true in the personal world, but what about professionally or politically? So let's suppose you're interviewing for a job. How much truth do you share? You know, in the old days, people say with AIDS, didn't really want to disclose that to an employer because of fear. And then there's the political realm or the public realm. You know, some of us say, oh, well, all politicians lie. But how do we discern this? It's not that easy. And, you know, I'm thinking about, for example, doctors. You know, how, a couple of you are doctors, give your patients bad news. You know, that's a difficult thing. And one study I read said, you know, this doctor works on pediatric oncology in Boston. And what he tries to do is give people staged pieces of information. So they're not, you know, giving it all the information at once. So all this is pretty heavy stuff. So in an attempt to lighten it up a bit, I turned to our trusty internet and typed in good quotes on truth. So here are a select few I came up with. Man is least himself when he talks in his own person. Give him a mask and he will tell you the truth. Now that was penned by Oscar Wilde a century ago. So give him a mask and he will tell the truth. I don't know. Oscar Wilde also said, the truth is rarely pure and never simple. Other quotes related to truth. There are no facts, only interpretation. Or I think my favorite is, trust your mother, but cut the cards. Three things cannot be long hidden. The sun, the moon, and the truth. And the last one I have is, if you tell the truth, you don't have to remember anything. So indeed, we can strive to apply methods and techniques for evaluating the accuracy of external truth and the relative worth of authority. But it's still complex and will never be resolved, as the parable I read on truth, falsehood, fire, and water reminds us. And I'll conclude with reading the end of that again. The parable concludes, truth and falsehood are destined to struggle. Sometimes truth will win, but other times falsehood will prevail. Then truth must rise up and fight again. Until the end of the world, truth must battle falsehood and must never rest or let down his guard, or he will be finished once and for all. And so truth and falsehood are fighting to this day. Blessed be. Amen.